Thank you for listening to Scandinavian Crimes Podcast. Be sure to check out the episode links and be part of our other social media platforms where you can leave a topic suggestion or even share some of your insights regarding the subject matter of the episode. We will always do our best to provide a well-researched episode, but sometimes due to limited access to information and translation issues, some information can be lost. It is therefore good to do your own research and get a deeper understanding of a case of your own interest. So with that all said, let us start today's episode.
Welcome to Scandinavian Crimes. My name is Devante, and say hello to my lovely co-host, Delilah.
Hi.
And on this podcast, we will cover famous Scandinavian criminals who made their mark throughout Scandinavian history. So today we embark on a really bone-chilling journey into a twisted and very corrupted world of James Schmidt. Now, he was a South Sudanese-born Danish serial killer and rapist. His horrifying spree of violence unfolded in a serene streets of Copenhagen's Østerbro district. Now, it left a trail of terror from February to March 2019. This is a story of a boy who, from a young age, showed signs that he would be a threat to women as well as the public. This case sparked intense controversy, raising disturbing questions about the competence of the authorities, the leniency showed towards Smith's previous convictions, and the shocking initial acquittal of one of the murders. Just so you're aware, even though his birth name is Lul Ye Fayin Lul, I will be referring to him as James Schmidt throughout the story. So sit back, relax, as we discuss the serial killer, James Schmidt. Born 1992 in South Sudan, James Schmidt was brought to Denmark at the tender age, where he settled in Holbæk alongside his family. While his mother's partner, an older man named Henning, treated him like his own son, a darker side of their relationship emerged. Henning's scolding for misbehavior and lack of obedience sowed the seeds of resentment in young Schmidt's heart. The first alarming incident occurred when Schmidt was only 10 years old. Accusations arose that he attempted to rape a 6-year-old girl, sending shockwaves to the community. However, due to his young age, no charges were pressed. At school, Schmidt presented a facade of a nice boy to his family, but his sinister reputation plagued him amongst female students as well as teachers. Rumors of grooming and groping circulating, foreshadowing a very monstrous path in which he would later take in his adult life. As the years pass, Schmidt's behavioral issues only continued to escalate, and his mother, unable to cope with his troublesome nature, sent him to a foster home. But this change of environment only fueled his violent tendencies and obsession with sex, leading to numerous relocations between various juvenile detention centers. Schmidt's life took a sinister turn after serving a 7-year prison sentence for a heinous crime, the rape of a 14-year-old girl, when he was simply just a juvenile himself. But his release was a prelude to an even darker and bigger chapter, as he unleashed a reign of terror that claimed the lives of 3 innocent prisoners while inside. Psychiatric evaluations painted a disturbing picture of Schmidt's psyche. A diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder revealed his complete lack of empathy for others' suffering, raising serious concerns about his potential for absolute danger. Despite the grave warnings of the imminent peril he posed, Schmidt was released in 2009 and assumed a new identity, James Schmidt. In the bustling streets of Copenhagen, he tried to carve a new path, presenting himself as a talented musician and a budding talent manager. But the facade of normalcy hid his motivations. Sometime around late 2017, Schmidt frequented an apartment complex in Østerbro. Unbeknownst to the residents, he was about to do something crazy. Between early 2018 and March 2019, a string of suspicious deaths plagued the complex, sending shivers down the spines of the community. The first death aroused suspicion was of the 83-year-old Eva Hofmeister on the 7th of February 2019. However, before authorities could act, her relatives believed her demise was due to natural causes and had her body cremated. But as the bodies continued to mount, investigators grew increasingly more suspicious. The death of the 80-year-old Peter Jensen Olsen on the 2nd of March raised even more questions, leading to an autopsy that revealed he had been strangled to death. Just 5 days later, on March 7th, the lifeless body of 81-year-old Inez Hasblad was discovered in her apartment. Her daughter, Malene, stumbled upon the gruesome scene, setting off an alarm bell in her mind. Malene's intuition proved crucial as she uncovered oddities around her mother's death. As she dug deeper, she realized her mother's bank card had been used, prompting her to notify the police immediately. The ensuing investigation led to the identification and arrest of Schmidt on March 9th. He was apprehended in front of the cinema Imperial after watching a screening of Captain Marvel, completely unaware that the walls were closing in on him. Interrogations with Smith revealed an evasive and implausible account of his possessions of Hasselblad's card. Despite his denials, authorities had enough evidence to charge him with 3 counts of murder as well as fraud. The media respected a gag during the initial trial withholding Schmidt's identity. However, later, revelations exposed his dark past, including his conviction for raping a minor under his previous name, Lol. As the trials unfolded, Schmidt's defense tried to undermine the murder charges, arguing he was merely a thief and not a cold-blooded killer. But the mounting evidence and damning psychiatric assessment portrayed deeply disturbed and dangerous individual. After the first trial, eventually there was an appeal to have a second trial. The legal proceedings of the second trial reached their crescendo. The spotlight had fallen on Schmidt, a figure whose fate was hung in the balance in this court. With the prosecution's arguments echoing in the courtroom chambers and the defense's words ringing in the air, the tension was palpable. It was in this pivotal moment that the presiding judge, the venerable Carsten Henriksen, extended an invitation that would pave the way for the turn of events that are about to transpire. Schmidt, clad in black jeans and a crisp white shirt, rose from his seat, a figure both resolute and enigmatic. He approached the microphone, the embodiment of gravity in this situation, and then with a quiet determination, he began to speak. James Schmidt clears his throat and says the following. Your honors, esteemed members of the press, I stand before you with a conviction not of my guilt, but of my innocence. A sentence has been passed for a crime I did not commit, and today I raise my voice to declare my unwavering intention to appeal this judgment to seek justice at the highest echelons, if possible. His words reverberated through the courtroom, each syllable carrying the weight of his conviction. The room itself seemed to hold its breath, suspended in a moment of defiant resolve. With an air of quiet authority, Schmidt continued, his voice once again unwavering, each word meticulously chosen to convey his perspective. The Supreme Court, in a previous ruling, acknowledged that I was not a danger to society. It granted me an opportunity to reintegrate into the fabric of our community. Yet today, all that was reinstated into my life has been unjustly stripped away. A ripple of intrigue spread through the onlookers as Schmidt referenced a prior legal chapter that has shaped his narrative. In 2012, the Supreme Court had recalibrated his destiny, substituting a custodial sentence with a term of 7 years, a decision grounded in his youth. The walls of Hurstedvester Prison, where he served his time, bore witness to another chapter, one of confrontations and clashes. Two violent encounters with prison officers, their origins rooted in his troubled path, stood starkly in contrast to the initial ruling. The narrative of danger echoed and refrained that led to the fateful conclusion. And so, in this climactic moment, Schmidt stood not just as a defendant, but as a symbol challenging the scales of justice, hoping that they tip in his favor. The courtroom, a theater of emotions and legal discourse, bore witness to his impassioned proclamation. He stood there and said the following. For the sake of fairness, for the preservation of truth, I stand firm in my resolve. I cast a beacon of appeal, a testament to the belief that justice shall prevail. And with his last word, the room seemed to exhale, releasing the tension that had gripped it. The legacy of James Schmidt's declaration would ripple through time, a testament to the enduring pursuit of justice in the face of adversity. So he thought. After the roller coaster of trials, the verdict was delivered, finding Schmidt guilty of two murders and sentencing him to life imprisonment. However, a subsequent trial brought new evidence resulting in his conviction for the third murder and a full life sentence. The case of James Schmidt is a harrowing reminder of the dark side of humanity, leaving the families of the victims forever haunted by an inexplicable act of ruthlessness by this killer.
Okay, so this was very, you know, heartbreaking in a way, and also harsh. I wanted to talk about more, you know, about his mental stage and why he ended up doing everything he was doing. And based on what I like, to me, it sounds like he has some type of like psychopathic traits rather than only having narcissistic traits. And the reason I say this is because it's like when he was younger, obviously he raped and hurt people around him with the lack of any consideration. And then he murdered elderly people for money, not caring about anything, you know, than wanting money, right? It just, to me, it seems like he has a lack of care for life, almost more like a psychopath than like, or a tendency of a psychopath than just only having narcissistic personality disorder. And like, I'm not saying they don't go hand in hand. Like, obviously, like if you really want, like a narcissistic person only think about themselves, right? But the reason I like what I have read, it seems like narcissistic, if you have narcissistic personality disorder, you're not as aggressive and hurt other people compared to like if you have like psychopathic traits. So that's why I feel like I think it's a mix of both of them. And another example was, for example, when he was acting as a nice guy, he seemed, you know, he wanted to be seen as a nice, like cool, charming guy, right? And that's not something you always do as a, if you have narcissistic personality disorder. To me, it seems very calculated. It seems like, as I said before, psychopathic traits. And the next thing I want to talk about is like, okay, but what can you do to prevent this development, right? Like, what can you treat it? Can you treat like having any type of like narcissistic personality disorder or like psychopathic or sociopathic? And I looked it up and it seems like it's complicated and hard to do with a very low success rate. And like, there is possibilities for treating sociopathic and narcissistic personality disorders, but it's hard. You have to have a lot of therapy, trying to like teach and like, it's a lot of therapy and even sometimes like drugs as well. But it doesn't, like, preferably they don't want to do that because there's a high chance of addiction and that's not good either. That's why they don't always prescribe medications, but that's also one type of treatment or like a mixture or combination of both. And it's like, and when it comes to psychopathic tendencies, or if you're a psychopath, there's like no, at the best of our knowledge today, there's no real cure for that. You can't really like give a pill or like instill empathy or prevent a murder on somebody who just, you know, don't care for that. So if the person like want to or really want to change, if you're a sociopath or have narcissistic personality disorder, if you really want to change, you can do that. But it's not really like that easy as I have understood it.
Also something that I want to actually talk about that I don't think I talked about the first time was that, ironically enough, even mental health. So basically Schmidt, he was from, was it South Sudan, right? Mm. So as we know, South Sudan has had a lot of like civil war and a lot of traumatic things as a group of people. So this is still being studied, but so far, based on research, this is something that is really coming to light, that, and also something that a lot of Black people experience in America and a lot of secondhand generation immigrants from a lot of war-torn countries or situations like, you know, Africans coming to America hundreds of years ago during slavery, is that trauma actually can be inherited. Mental health and mental, you know, deficiencies in terms of how we process trauma, and it can physically alter our DNA. Trauma has been proven to physically alter your DNA. This is also something we see prevalent nowadays, where people who typically have forms of like sometimes depression, anxiety, it's very likely that someone in your immediate family, whether it be your parent or even an uncle or somebody, is probably suffering from it too, because unfortunately, you know, like I said, mental trauma can alter DNA, because depending on what you're experiencing, what you're feeling, your sense of fight or flight is either active or responding in a certain way. And trauma over long periods of time causes your body to change in order to adapt to survive, in theory. So the reason I wanted to bring that up is because he comes from a country, he directly came from a country where, especially at the time as well, I think he's as old as we are. So in the 90s, I think they was having issues in South Sudan, even in the 90s, early 2000s, like there was a war going on, I believe. Don't hold me to that, you know, but I believe within a couple years, even if it was a little before he was born, he came from a traumatic situation. His mom, whoever his dad is, you know, they came from trauma. And it's likely that because of that trauma, because of the war-torn area, because of the lack of resources, the lack of mental health support, it is entirely possible that due to these scenarios, this is what also encouraged a child to be born with, you know, narcissistic personality disorders, to be a sociopath, and also to kind of have like these psychopathic tendencies where he doesn't understand pain. Because, or like, you know, even people's emotions, when you think about it, it's an adaptation. Imagine growing up or even having family in an environment where it was very deadly. And imagine caring for every single person that died in a war. Eventually, your mind will shut down. Just like when you experience physical pain, you pass out. When it gets too painful, your mind has to do something to adapt to the environment. So it could very much be a byproduct of coming from a war-torn country that altered his parents' DNA because of their environment, which then affected him. And now he was born in a situation where he cannot sympathize with emotions. He doesn't understand suffering. So it's a very multi-layered experience when it comes to like a lot of trauma, and how trauma can not only affect the single person itself, but even their children, and how it could be passed down from generation to generation. And even studies going on to why serial killers are predominantly, you know, of Eurocentric descent. You know, there's correlations between trauma, mental health, and all these things based on, yeah, genetics. You know, so unfortunately, genetics plays a huge part in why some people come out with mental health issues versus others, and what types of mental health issues you have. So, you know, it's unfortunately, that's a situation where I at least what I'm kind of taking a stab at is likely to be involved in his case.
I also wanted to like look, like try to find like how, like, are you really like born with it, or do you have just genetic components, and whatever is happening in the environment can make you become more like, it's like, it's hard for me to like find, I don't know, maybe it's still researched on, but it sounds to me that, oh well, if you're a psychopath, then you were born with it and there's nothing you could do, like kind of like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say that as well. I think In a lot of cases, this is my personal belief, so do not take this as fact. I think in a lot of cases, it's a multi-layered situation. Genetic predisposition is not a guarantee, but it is still a decently likely factor in some situations. And then environment can exacerbate the issue to make that genetic predisposition active. So I'm going to give you a very simple example. This is not, you know, this is for everyone just to wrap your head around the concept of why like addiction and stuff like that is very hard to deal with. So let's say you grew up in a healthy home, you know, your parents, you know, didn't really let you overeat, you know, or anything like that. You know, you ate normally as a child all the way until you were like, let's say 20, 22. Now, you have like someone in your family has the genetic predisposition for addiction. You know this because I'm pretty sure I'm pretty sure you know somebody who has a family member who's addicted to alcohol or, you know, addicted to something. But so, you know, it's a possibility that you can have that genetic predisposition. And let's say when you're in your 20s, you experience a really bad breakup and you don't have any coping mechanisms. It can trigger you to, let's say you start eating and then you feel better. Well, now your brain, because of an environment, has caused it to understand that food makes me feel better. Then the addiction starts because of genetic predisposition that had already existed a part of your genes. So it's not one or the other. It's more likely that it's multiple things that fed into each other that causes that genetic predisposition to become active and prevalent in someone's life. So in his case, I agree. I think it's a multi-layer issue. I think genetics was a part of it. The trauma that altered his brain from multiple generations of experiencing a war-torn country, and then him being born, and then the environment, which was, I think, part as well, the abuse probably triggered it. It's hard to say. Maybe he could have gotten better. Maybe if the mother was more supportive, there's a possibility that he could have actually managed his behavior, but we will never know because it's hard to say. It's truly hard to determine what could have turned out.
Yeah, that's pretty much it of what I wanted to say. And if there's nothing else, I guess that's pretty much it. I also want to say, I want to say something though. Obviously we did not support what Smith has done previously. It's, you know, we did not think that's okay to do. And obviously all of this is only for educational purposes. We want to understand why everything is happening so that we can like prevent that in the future. But yeah, so you all understand that we don't think like, oh, that's, we feel bad for him. It's okay for him to do that. No.
Yeah.
And you know, we can see that the case was pretty much like he was caught in 4K. We could see that he's pretty much, you know, even though he tried to like, you know, charm his way and say that I didn't do it and everything, he was, you know, there was evidence. We all saw, like we see. So he was caught in 4K. Everything he did was not like, it's not okay to murder anybody or rape anybody. Like we all know that. But this is for educational purposes. We want to tell you guys like everything about a story or about a crime committed so that we can understand and prevent it in the future. So yeah,
you have to as they would say you have to understand the problem in order to fix the problem.
Exactly. I couldn't have said it better than you did. It's exactly like that.
So I guess we'll just have to wrap up the episode on a good note. So what is something that you know, you have a taste for?
Fruits. I'm so craving fruits right now.
I can definitely go for some good, juicy, succulent, sweet watermelons. I know that's racial stereotypes, but, you know, I can go for it.
I was thinking about grapes, but also...
Grapes sound good,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, but also I'm kind of like, for some reason, papaya. And then...
I haven't had papaya in a while.
What's it called? Grape... Wait... Pompom papaya? What is it called? The one with the red seeds in it in English.
Papaya?
No, it's like the red. It's like red. Huh?
Pomegranate?
Thank you. That's what I want.
I'm so done. That does sound good, though. Yeah, I can go for some watermelon. It's just one of fruit kind of vibe today. Watermelon sounds delicious. I know stereotypes. Don't judge me. If you do, you're prejudiced. And yeah. So once again, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I hope you learn something. I hope it expands your mind. I hope you can use this information to help keep you safe in your day-to-day lives. And we shall see you next week with a very succulent, juicy case that I'm pretty sure you're all going to enjoy very much so. So I'll catch you in the next one. And stay alive and stay healthy, my friends.
Yeah.
Peace out.
Bye.